I'm Christopher Lydon with the Indian writer who's tracked the migration, soul by soul, it seems, of a nation of villages into megacities on the scale of Bombay, now Mumbai, where people named the trickle of the open slum sewer after a river back home. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. And this is the third chapter of the story from Brown's Year of India. Suketu Mehta's masterwork, Maximum City, did for Bombay what the immortals Dickens and Balzac did for London and Paris, except that the sprouting of mushroom slums and penthouses in India may run 20 times faster and bigger. And still, Suketu Mehta is telling me, from the old India of starving cows and sadhus to the new one of Bollywood and billionaires, is a very old ping-pong game of ideas going back and forth between India and the United States. Suketu Mehta, we know you as an American by now who went back to India to write this incredible Dickensian portrait of Bombay, Mumbai, Maximum City, the anti-travel book, you say, half-jokingly. And yet, all the more after Slumdog Millionaire, we're drawn to this dystopia of city life in the extreme. Is it part of the story that Africa, India, China, who knows, maybe all of us will live in a Bombay someday?
God, I hope not. Bombay is an exemplar of a new kind of global megacity. So a megacity, by definition, is a city with more than 10 million people. Mm. And Bombay right now has over 20 million people. So it's a double megacity. So there's a group of these cities like Bombay, Sao Paulo, Jakarta, Lagos, which are cities that have these tremendous population influxes from the countryside and have a kind of chaotic city government. So most municipal services that we take for granted in the cities of the West are essentially privatized. So if you live in a slum in Bombay or Lagos, you're responsible for your own garbage pickup, your own electricity, your own water supply, your own security, transport. So the government is essentially absent in large pockets of these cities. And still, they remain beacons of hope for the young people in their countries. Also, within these megacities, there, you know, some are more successful than others. So Bombay is not Kinshasa. But they're also characterized by islands of extreme wealth in the middle of seas of extreme poverty. The first and the third worlds today aren't on opposite sides of the globe. They live side by side. So I know people in Bombay who send their laundry to Paris. They like their suits to be dry cleaned in Paris. I know people in Bombay who can tell you where to get the best foie gras in Paris or the best pizza in New York, but have no idea where to get the best bhelpuri in Bombay.
I want you to help us understand this Year of India, as they're calling it at Brown University, and a lot of campuses, a lot of museums, a lot of places around the world, particularly at a moment when President Obama says the U.S. relationship with India is going to be the model sort of dancing couple among great giant nations in the 21st century. India was a nation of villages in Gandhi's time. Farmers were sacrosanct to Nehru, which is only yesterday. So much has changed in this new world of India, the nuclear power, India, the land of billionaires and Bangalore technology and all that stuff. But just start with how India became, from a nation of villages, a nation above all of cities. How did this happen to Bombay?
Gandhi said India is a nation of villages. And he also advised, if you want to know the real India, go to the villages. Mm. He would tell people who would come to his ashrams in the cities, you know, go to the villages, that's where you'll... This is no longer true. The action now, economically, socially, culturally, is in the cities. What's happening is that the countryside is becoming depopulated. Agriculture is no longer viable in large parts of India. because of the international system of agricultural trade and tariffs, under which American cotton can actually be cheaper than Indian cotton on the world market because America subsidizes its cotton farmers to the tune of billions of dollars. So what happens is that Indian cotton farmers tell their children to go to the cities to make a better life for themselves. So there's four major metropolises. For a long time, they were just called the metros in India. Bombay, Calcutta, Delhi, and Chennai, formerly Madras. That's also changed. Now there are many, many more of these metros. So there's a whole second tier of cities such as Ahmedabad or Nagpur, or Visakhapatnam, Bhopal, which are already megacities or on their way to becoming megacities. This is not unique to India. China, for example, is creating almost 100 new cities from scratch. The world's biggest city in terms of population is a city called Chongqing in China, which was created by merging five different cities into one municipal area, which has a population of some 35 million people. So there's this love affair with cities on the planet, and something signal has occurred in human evolution. So right about now, for the first time in history, more of us human beings live in cities than in villages. We've become an urban species, like cockroaches or rodents. We don't know what to do in the countryside.
For a writer, how different is it or how similar to all those French novels of the 19th century, Balzac especially, of village guys going to see if they could make it in Paris, or Dickens characters or Hardy characters finding their way to London? What's new and different in the Indian China story?
Well, all of these people are certainly, Dickens certainly is a lodestar for most Indian writers attempting to understand this. But in cities like Bombay, this growth is occurring radically more swiftly. So Greater Bombay adds a million new people every year. New York, which is going from 8 million to 9 million people over 20 years. I mean, the administration is panicked. How are we going to accommodate these million people over the next 20 years? You know, Bombay is going from 20 to 21 million people as we speak. So one is the rate of growth is much faster. And for many of these migrants, they see these cities as way stations. So a small subset of these migrants who come in from Bihar to Bombay would stay in Bombay for a while, and then they or their children would move on to the Middle East or to England and to America. So this rate of movement also is unprecedented. Today, for the first time in human history, 175 million people out of the 6 billion people on the planet are living in a country other than the one they were born in. So, you know, what is exile when a round trip home is $500? The immigrants that come to the cities of the West can also go back home much more rapidly, which is why you see these immigrant quarters in Paris or New York or Toronto, which where they don't melt because they're in continuous touch with their homelands. And the same sort of thing in Bombay. The way to understand a city like Bombay is to understand that it is really less a city than a collection of villages. The villagers have left their villages, but they brought their villages with them. So in the slum areas of Bombay, and 60% of Bombayites live in slums, in the slum areas you will see that they will rename their particular area of the slum after the name of the village. If there is a sewage canal or a ditch, they will rename it after the river of their particular province. They will plant the same trees. They will erect the same temples with the same deities. So, you know, the first thing that the migrant to the city seeks is a kind of spatial familiarity. And so he will transpose the geography of the land left behind onto the land newly inhabited.
Describe the peculiar effect of Bollywood and Bombay, where so much of those Bollywood movies is shot in the places, which reinforces this image of the city as a shining dream, a place to go to, a place to find yourself in the bright lights.
In order to understand Bombay properly, it's essential to understand Bollywood. So just as cinema is a mass dream of the audience, Bombay is a mass dream of the peoples of India, largely because of Bollywood. So most Indians and most people in the former Soviet Union and the Middle East are aware of what Bombay looks like because they've seen it in the Bollywood movies, where Hollywood had the budgets to create extravagant sets. You know, they could recreate Venice or Paris, the sets of Universal Studios. The Bombay filmmakers had to rely on the city of Bombay. So they went out and, you know, shot scenes on the streets. So when the villagers arrive in Bombay, they're already familiar with the promenade along Marine Drive, the Hanging Gardens, the Houses of the Stars at Bandra. They've seen all of this in the movie, so it's a kind of mythic land for them. When they come and live in Bombay, in spite of all the hardships of living in a slum, they also participate in the glamorous life, in the cinematic life. So there's kind of an economic value to spectacle, which is yet to be calculated by economists.
So Keetu Mehta, can you explain to me what's happened in the Indian mind and spirit to ideas about power and wealth? Till yesterday, surely till the liberalization of investments in India 20 years ago, India was a very, very poor country with an anti-imperial, anti-power mindset, embodied by Gandhi, of course, and Nehru, and in India in general. India seems to be swimming very, very happily now in a world of its own imperial fantasies. How did this happen? And what remains of that Gandhian outlook, do you think?
Well, when I was growing up, India to the West was starving cows and sadhus. And now it's call centers and the fabulous Ambani brothers.
Yes,
who
exactly.
Are the richest
and nuclear weapons.
Men in India. And nuclear weapons, that's right. It's so things have changed, and it's also a country which, you know, while Dubai is going bankrupt, it's enjoying a 6% growth rate, and it's on track to going back to 9% over the next couple of years. And for the longest time while I was growing up, the Indian economy grew at a steady rate of 3.5%, which was so steady that economists called it the Hindu growth rate. So under Indira Gandhi, India was officially called the Sovereign Socialist Republic of India. So the word socialist was in the official title of the country. It was a pretty watered-down socialism, but it was more like an oligopoly where the government awarded licenses to make everything from textiles to cars to these favored industrial families that had political connections or could bribe enough numbers of politicians. So it was never actually socialism. But growing up in India, we had very few electronic goodies, for example. So whenever relatives would come visiting from abroad, their bags would always be packed with, toasters, razors, radios, any kind of appliances. So all these things had to be brought in or smuggled in. And we still had this allegiance to Gandhi, which even back then wasn't completely real, but he was at least celebrated in the textbooks. And the current generation of Indians have this idea of Gandhi as an important figure in the freedom struggle, but the rest of his message about environmentalism and about self-sufficiency and village government, all of that's largely fallen by the wayside. So India seems to have, well, at least urban middle-class India seems to have embraced its role as this economic superpower of the 20th century. The tourist brochures say, incredible India. Well, I don't believe it. The facts still remain that 40% of the country is illiterate. That's 400 million people. About the same percentage live under the poverty line. Malnutrition rates among children are higher than in sub-Saharan Africa. So this other India is largely invisible in the world because it's in the villages. It's in the east. There's an active Maoist insurgency in the eastern states, which is hardly ever mentioned in press reports. Tens of thousands of farmers kill themselves every year because they can't repay agricultural debts. Now, agriculture in India is getting steadily more expensive. This was one of the byproducts of the Green Revolution, which allowed India to feed itself, but also made it much more expensive to buy the genetically modified crops and fertilizers and insecticides necessary to have a sort of modern farm with, you know, farm technology, which the vast majority of Indian farmers cannot afford. So there is this, you know, there's this India of the cities, this aggressive, self-confident India, and a democratic India, it must be said. I mean, here's a country of a billion people, 80% of which is Hindu, and it is today ruled by a Sikh prime minister, a woman who's president who succeeded a Muslim man as president, a chief justice who is a Dalit, a former untouchable, and an Italian Catholic widow who's leader of the governing coalition. Yeah. By contrast, it took the United States some 220 years to elect anybody that was not Christian, white, and male, even as vice president.
Americans by now are in love with Indian writers, maybe starting with Salman Rushdie, including you, Arundhati Roy, Jhumpa Lahiri, Anita Desai, all sorts of people. Where do we tune in on the spirit life of the new India and in the life of millions, hundreds of millions of poor people?
Well, all the writers that you mentioned, including myself, we write in English.
Yes.
Now, it's a language that's, you know, 2% of the country reads. That's still 20 million people. That's, and, you know, 10% are conversant, so that's 100 million people. That's larger than the population of England. But it's still not. The language of the poor is not English. I mean, it's Hindi, it's Bengali, it's Tamil. And these writers are still not accessible to the West, partly because there aren't good translations out there, partly because publishers, for whatever reason, aren't interested in Indian writers who write in Indian languages other than English. So, you know, Orhan Pamuk can write in Turkish and Haruki Murakami can write in Japanese, but the best-known Indian writers write in the colonial language, which by now we've also sort of Indianized. It's what Salman Rushdie calls the chutney-fied language of the Bombay streets. So it is difficult to get access to that other India because it also tends to not be on the internet. I mean, you could go and read, if you can read Gujarati or Hindi, there are these papers on the internet. But
can't do that. And I don't find it in the Times of India online.
You will certainly not find it in the Times of India.
So how do we read through Tom Friedman and Nanda Nilekani and these voices of the new India to something a little more convincing?
You have to read things like the Economic and Political Weekly, which is not a terribly exciting publication, but it's...
we'll try it.
Or you have to read P. Sainath's book called Everybody Loves a Good Drought, which is sort of dispatches from the poorest parts of India. So there are some reporters who are doing this kind of reporting from the other India, but no one that's really broken out in a big way in the West. All these countries, these cities, have an official story and an unofficial story. So the official story is the language of the government plans, the real estate brochures, and the unofficial narratives are quieter. They are, you know, migrants Skyping each other, local language newspapers. Mm-hmm. They're found in myths, which are told in temples. One of the places where I found these stories was the letter writer. So opposite the general post office in Bombay, there's a group of scribes who sit, and illiterate villagers come to them, and they write out letters on their behalf to the villagers. So I would often just sit with these letter writers and hear these stories.
It's a scene out of Kipling, I think, out of Kim. What did you hear? What did you find?
A lot of it involved the phrase, I am sending you money soon. but then there were a bunch of prostitutes who would regularly come to the letter writers to help them craft letters to men that they were bilking or fleecing, or to their parents in the villages who they were lying to about their jobs. So they would write out these letters on behalf of the prostitutes, saying, I'm working as a secretary in this big company in Bombay, and here's my latest paycheck. And so sometimes the parents would come to the city looking for their daughters. And the address given would be the letter writer's address. That's where the letters would come to. So the parents would come to the letter writers looking for their daughters. And then they were practiced in the art of holding off the parents and sending a messenger to the girl to alert her that her parents were on the lookout for them. Mm. So these stories were, no one was sitting with the letter writers noting these stories, these unofficial narratives of the great city. And I found all over Bombay all these millions of uncollected stories, so much so that one of the people I write about in my book is a runaway poet from Bihar. And he heard about my project. I was going around the city getting these stories. And he said, I have a title for your book. You should call it Untold Stories or Untellable Stories. He was a boy of 17 who had run away from the poorest state of India, Bihar, to come to the big city, not to work in the movies or not to make a fortune, but to write poetry. He thought of himself as a poet. And his father was a science teacher and wanted him to be a scientist. So this kid slept on the sidewalks, and he took me all around the city and showed me how he ate, where he went to the bathroom, what he had to pay to go to the bathroom, the small and great scams of the city. And he went all around the city writing poetry. And then I asked him if he had contacted his parents. He had run away from home. And he said he hadn't. And so I said, well, he might want to notify them. They must be worried. And he wrote a postcard to his father. And his father took the next train over from Bihar. And I got a phone call one morning from the kid saying his father had arrived in Bombay and was taking him back to Bihar. Would I meet them for breakfast? Mm. And I did. And the father was a lovely man, a science teacher from a small village. And he said he'd come there to collect his son. The parents had been worried sick about him. And I said, well, now that you're here, how long will you stay? He said, oh, we are taking this afternoon's train back. Now, Bihar is at the other end of India. It's a three-day train journey. He had just traveled for 3 days. He had come that morning, and he was going back that afternoon. I said, why don't you stay? This is this fabulous city, this great city. You know, you can see the gateway of India. You can see where the Bollywood stars walk around. He said, no, I have no interest in all of this. I want to get out of this city as fast as possible because all these big buildings here, they have been built by stealing somebody else's money. Essentially, he was paraphrasing Balzac without knowing it, behind every great fortune is a great crime. And he said, I have no interest in Bollywood. I just want to get my son out of here. And his son kept saying to his father, but this is my karma bhumi. This is the proving ground of my destiny, the land of my destiny. And the father said, no, this is papani bhumi. This is the land of sin. So two very different conceptions of the city. Mm. And the kid ended up going back with his father, at least on that afternoon train. And then he left again. And when I last heard from him, he was in Kanpur, another North Indian city. Mm.
What did you learn on the trains?
Well, I saw the most surprising thing on the Bombay trains. These are incredibly crowded places. And when you first look at a Bombay train. It's like some kind of moving ant colony, because there's people everywhere. You can barely discern the shape of the train underneath all those people. There's people holding on to the windows, sometimes on the roofs of the trains, hanging on from the open doorways. And when you actually try to get in, it seems impossible that any human being could actually stand there in comfort, much less sit there. But I kept going back to the trains because it's a moving social laboratory for the city. And I found that the way people make this hellish commute bearable is by forming a community inside the trains. Mm. So people will ride with what they call their train group every day, and they'll go to the same compartment of the same train every morning, and they will meet up with the same friends who they will never see outside of the train. And then with these friends, they will sing or make jokes, so much so that people in all of these trains know where to find the best songs, where to find the best jokes. And with the train group, they'll share their breakfast. Everybody will bring, you know, the breakfasts of their own ethnicities and share it. There'll be people selling things. So in this way, this inhuman commute is made bearable. And also for another really moving thing, which is that if you're late for one of these trains and the train's running out of the station, you can run up to the train and hold out your hand. And then all these hands will reach out for you and take you on board. There's no doors. They're open doorways. And they'll grab you on board and make space for you when none exists to take one more person with them, because they'll empathize with you and know that, you know, if you miss this train, your boss is going to get mad at you. A friend of mine who would take the train from Mira Road in the north to Churchgate, a two-hour commute every day, each way, so 4 hours in total. Mm. And then a little later, he told me that he had found a job near his home, so he wouldn't have to commute on the trains anymore. I said, that's great, you know, we can skip the commute. He said, well, once a week, I still take the train to Churchgate. I said, why once a week? Well, what do you have to do over there? He said, well, I miss my train group. So he actually, once a week, still does it so he can hang out with his friends and then takes the train back.
Come back to the White House with President Obama and Prime Minister Singh and this exemplary relationship. One of the things they didn't tell us was that that very traditional-looking Indian with the Sikh turban is, in fact, the great liberalizer of investment in India, the man who's made the boom, such as it is. What is the reality of this relationship, do you think, not just commercially, but diplomatically, even militarily, could be in Afghanistan, but then also philosophically, culturally, spiritually, literarily? What should we make of it?
Well, George Bernard Shaw once said, America and England are two great countries separated by a common language. So I feel that India and the United States are two great democracies separated by a common way of thinking about the world.
Really?
There's no reason why these countries shouldn't be the best of friends. But they haven't. They've been at loggerheads. They've, throughout the Nixon years, the Johnson years, I mean, during all these years, there was this idea that India was tilting towards the Soviet Union. And so the United States had to back Pakistan. It changed during the Clinton years, and actually changed quite a bit during the George Bush years, George Bush the younger. And Bush negotiated a nuclear deal under which the provisions of the non-proliferation treaty were ignored to give India access to civilian nuclear technology. This in spite of the fact that, you know, India had conducted nuclear tests and, you know, is a nuclear power. So this made Bush enormously popular in India. And it was one of the few countries in which George Bush never really lost his popularity. Mm. But this relationship has been more fraught than it needs to be at the political level. But it's also another kind of relationship which has been going on for now centuries, which is this ping-pong game of ideas between India and America. So when the Bhagavad Gita, that great philosophical text, first started appearing in English translations through the Germans and the British, and it made its way to the Transcendentalists.
Here in New England, you mean?
In New England and all across America. I mean, when Walt Whitman wrote Leaves of Grass, Emerson called it, quote, a curious combination of the New York Herald and the Bhagavad Gita. So a young school teacher put up a shack on the shores of a pond not too far from here in Providence and started reading the Bhagavad Gita every morning. And its message of doing your duty, doing your dharma in the face of overwhelming odds really resonated with him. And when the Spanish-American War broke out, this young man, Henry David Thoreau, refused to pay the poll tax and was sentenced to spend a night in jail. And when he came out, he wrote a short tract called On the Duty of Civil Disobedience. Now, go forward a few decades, and a young Indian lawyer is kicked off a train in South Africa because he doesn't, he's a colored man in a first-class train compartment. So he's thrown out and spends the night shivering on the station of Pietermaritzburg. And then he looks for a way to constructively channel his anger. And someone gives this young man a copy of Thoreau's book on the duty of civil disobedience. And he reads it and then goes on to lead the Satyagraha movement in South Africa. This man was Mahatma Gandhi, of course. A few decades later, an African-American preacher in the American South is looking for political philosophy to bring his people equal rights. This is Martin Luther King, of course. And King's mentor was a sociologist named Howard Thurman, who had studied with Gandhi. And King later went to India and visited Gandhi's ashram. So he was tremendously influenced by Gandhi's philosophy of nonviolence. And then King's ideas resonated with the Indian Dalits, the former untouchables, and they used American civil rights struggle as a sort of model for their own quest to win equal rights in India. So these things have always gone back and forth, back and forth.
Well, I was going to say, and then at school opening this year in America, in the South, a young girl asked Barack Obama, who would he have dinner with if he could wave a magic wand, living or dead? And he says, Gandhi. So the conversation continues, but it's changed. Gandhi's grandson imagined that conversation over dinner in which Gandhi would say, be real, you're the British in Afghanistan, and who invited you? He went on to say that in thinking about Afghanistan, Gandhi would tell Obama to remember the poorest people in the world and plan his policy accordingly. Are we still in that ping-pong conversation?
Well, we are still having this conversation, except now the conversation is between Mukesh Ambani and Steven Spielberg. and Mukesh Ambani, the richest man. Well, it's actually Anil Ambani, his brother. These two brothers are the richest men in India, and one of them has just got a controlling interest in DreamWorks, so Steven Spielberg, I'm sure, will soon be making Bollywood movies. So there's a conversation now between the elites in India and the elites in America. And they go to the same schools, they hang out in the same clubs and restaurants. This other conversation between these truly visionary minds, I'm sure it's still carrying on, but it's hard to tell when the next volley will come over the net.
America and India are both sort of rebel children against the British Empire with a kind of anti-imperial, anti-colonial thing in their DNA. And yet, in the 21st century, they've also learned to love their own imperial power.
Well, now, there's a bit of a difference. I mean, India doesn't really have imperial designs on other countries. It doesn't, you know, want colonies, with the exception of Sikkim, which was an independent country which India saw fit to just take over and incorporate within the Indian Union. But India, like China, is less interested in having colonies than in having access to resources. So both of these countries, although huge, need oil, need things like uranium to power their nuclear reactors, need all kinds of resources and markets. Mm. So its imperial ambitions right now, I think, are more economic than political. One of the things that India wants is a seat in the UN Security Council. And I think there's no reason why the world's second biggest country shouldn't have a seat at the table. And I think it's okay if France or Britain is kicked off, because they've, by now they've become minor powers on the world stage.
We'll try to deliver it. So, Keetu Mehta, it's good enough reason to have a year of India just to meet you finally. I loved Maximum City from the beginning, and I'm so grateful for this conversation. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Chris. It's a pleasure being on.
Paul McCarthy edited this conversation with Suketu Mehta, whose work in progress is about immigrants in New York. Our Brown University interns Hannah Olson and Ben Mandelkern are with us book by book, city by city, through this year of India. Join us with a comment, an idea, a memory, an angle on India at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lighton. Thank you for joining the conversation.